Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Can a new juvenile criminal justice plan keep young offenders from a life of crime? Prince George's County State's Attorney Aisha Braveboy hopes so. Last month, she announced a plan to designed to keep juvenile offenders out of the school-to-prison pipeline. Tonight, we'll ask Braveboy about that and other criminal justice issues in the county. She joins me in studio along with our guest reporter, Tracy Wilkins, Prince George's County Bureau Chief for News 4 Washington. Lines are open. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment for Prince George's County State's Attorney Aisha Braveboy. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Certainly, you're welcome to tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Ms. Braveboy and Tracy, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Let me first start with this program that you announced. It is a diversion program for juvenile offenders who have committed nonviolent crimes. What was the genesis of this for you?
Well, one of the things that I noticed even before I became state's attorney was that a lot of young people who ended up offending in our communities had some, you know, mental health issues, were going through some social issues, or who were victims of violence or witnessed violence in their homes and communities. And so what I realized is that we won't be able to really impact that young person's behavior if we don't begin to address some of the underlying issues that are driving and informing their behavior. So for about 15 years, I worked with a juvenile diversion program in Prince George's County called the Community Public Awareness Council. We had a very high success rate. So the young people going through our program did not reoffend. And in fact, their grades improved. Their attendance in school improved. Their parents said that their behavior even towards them improved. And so what I understood going in is that it is very important that we begin again to address some of these underlying issues, provide structure, provide accountability. And when we give young people that opportunity, they do turn their lives around and make better decisions in the future.
How did this program that you are now spearheading, how will it work? So let's say a 14-year-old kid is caught shoplifting.
Sure.
What happens from that point?
So those charges, if they're charged by the police, those charges would not be filed automatically with the Department of Juvenile Services. They would first come to us for us to review. If we believe that that child is suitable for one of our diversion options, we will divert that child into one of those programs, and therefore the child will not have an actual juvenile record. They won't be officially, formally charged with a crime. If they complete the diversion program, then those charges will never be filed. If they don't complete the diversion program, then those charges could be filed with the Department of Juvenile Services.
But what would that diversion program look like? How long would it be, for example?
So we have a few different options depending on the needs of the child. And the great thing is that we've been able to really partner with some amazing community-based organizations as well as universities like Bowie State University. We're working with their social work program to match social workers up with young people who have very specific needs. So if they need tutoring, we have partners who will help with the tutoring. Some need group counseling or mentorship. We have that. Some of our young people need more therapeutic intervention. And so we actually have medical partners who will provide counseling, psychological services, and other services that the child needs. We also will do an assessment of the family. If the family has, let's say, they're housing insecure, which means they don't have, housing that's reliable, or they're food insecure. They're not eating every night because the family doesn't have enough resources, then we will direct those young people and their families to the Department of Social Services. We will work with case managers to ensure that they have what they need to be successful. So this is really a holistic approach to addressing young people who come in contact with the criminal justice system.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to Prince George's County State's Attorney Aisha Braveboy about law and order and criminal justice issues in the county. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Of course, we will be taking your phone calls even after 7:30 on SiriusXM Channel 141. Tracy, I know you're chomping at the bit to get in on this conversation. Please help yourself.
Well, I think that there are two sides to this argument, and there are plenty of people who hear what the state's attorney is saying, and they're very excited about the possibility of some of these children being redirected from falling into this system that is set up for failure and is very difficult to get out of once you're in it. But then we have victims of crime
yes.
who say, we are not punishing kids enough. So the stats point to that the majority of the children who are incarcerated as juveniles are children of color. And a large percentage of them in the state of Maryland are coming out of Prince George's County specifically. So something has to be done to address this problem, and approaching it from a social perspective is an interesting one. But what do you say to the residents who say, this is not a time for us to be lenient, this is a time for us to be more severe, more harsh to deter this crime that we're dealing with?
Well, and I appreciate that. And when I rolled out this new initiative, what I said is that we are victim focused, that part of the rehabilitation process is making the victim whole and acknowledging the wrongdoing, because our victims are important to us. But what we have to do is ensure that we have a system that not only provides for safety today, but into the future. What we know is that 52 to 57% of young people who are incarcerated end up reoffending as adults. So if we just put a Band-Aid on it by putting them in jail and not giving them the appropriate level of intervention, then what they're going to do is continue to offend and then have more serious offenses. You know, when I review, and I review all of the major cases that come through my office, and we often look at the records of the individuals who are offending, many of them have juvenile records. So yes, they were they committed a crime as a juvenile. They then were incarcerated or confined for a period of time, many of them. But when they got out, because they did not get the services they need, the intervention that they needed, they continued to offend. And so we can continue to do that. But it's clearly the system and a structure that does not work.
To that point, though, just kind of going down sure. the list of the resources that you just mentioned, frankly speaking, that's a lot of stuff. I mean, because there are a lot of juvenile offenders out there, and they're rolling through the system like oranges, based on. Unless something has changed since your press conference, have you found funding for this? Because it's going to require a great deal of work.
Well, let me tell you, we have been able to reach out to partners who want to be a part of this. They've been doing it for years without funding from us. So we're working with established programs that have proven success records in our county. Now, for our medical partners, they can be reimbursed for their services through Medicaid. And so they have not asked for resources from us. Now, certainly we will go after grants because we think that maybe we could do more and reach out to communities that may be underserved, including our Hispanic community. We also have a significant number of LGBTQIA youth in the system as well. And so we want to make sure that we have partnerships with organizations that can better serve those youth that have been underrepresented just in social justice, period. The truth is, a lot of this does not require funding. What it requires is a commitment And it requires know-how. And so we've been able to partner with organizations that have that commitment and that know-how.
How long is that program? You mentioned in the example that I asked you about 14-year-old shoplifting. How long? How long would he or she be in that?
Yeah, it really depends on the nature of the offense and the needs of the child. And so what we have a relationship with our medical service providers to do is do an assessment of the child and determine the appropriate setting for that child. And so some programs might be 2 to 3 months or 4 months. Some might be longer.
I'd like to ask a question about the school system. I covered your press conference, and I asked this question then, and I think it's an important one.
Yes.
Because so many of these incidents with juveniles, it starts in or around the school. And Prince George's County is working to expand the number of police officers who are in the schools. And by and large, officers arrest. That's what they do. They put kids in handcuffs. They arrest. So from there, depending on how that child interacts with the officer, charges can quickly mount for children.
Escalate, yes.
So let's talk about how the school system is partnering with you and what you expect that relationship to look like as you deal with officers who are helping to police inside of the schools.
Absolutely. Well, I think that Dr. Golson, who's our superintendent, said it best. The officers should be mentors first. And so the first interactions that the officer has with a child in the school should not be a negative one. And so they want the officer to be more part of the school structure and what happens in the school every day. And what I think the teachers and administrators also need to understand is that officers should not be called to respond to what may be classroom management issues. The officers should respond to criminal issues that are occurring in the school. So I think we all can play a role in helping to direct teachers to the appropriate resources when a child is acting up in class. Because let's say they're acting up does not mean that they are committing a crime. They may be violating school policy, but it has not risen to the level of actually committing a criminal act. But what often happens is that school resource officer may be called. Now the situation escalates because, well, a child, when approached by an authority figure, if they're already acting out, they continue to act out. If they interface and physically touch the officer, now it's disorderly, it's assault on a police officer, it's a litany of charges that young person could be charged with. So you've gone from someone who may have been, violating school policy or classroom policy to now someone who's been charged with an actual crime. And those are the situations we're trying to reduce or eliminate.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking with the Prince George's County's top prosecutor, Prince George's County State's Attorney, Aisha Braveboy. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Let me go to Joan. Joan calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Joan. What's on your mind?
So Washington, D.C. has the same program, the Alternatives to the Court Experience. So I'm just curious to find out whether or not she's consulted with D.C. to find out how their youth diversion program is doing. And if so, has that proved to be helpful? And if not, is there any plans to do so?
Well, I know Attorney General Carl Racine very well. I know that he is certainly a leader in youth justice reform. So I have met with him on a couple of different occasions. Our program is uniquely tailored to Prince George's County. But absolutely, I have consulted with him. But again, we have community partners that have been working very successfully in our community, and we're working with them, and we think we're going to have a lot of success.
Joan, thank you for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One other question on this. When do you anticipate this starting, or is it now in the works?
It's happening now.
Mm-hmm. One other thing, too, and actually this kind of goes along with some of the reporting that Tracy has done, because I remember during the press conference and also you mentioned earlier you were talking about mental health issues and other issues. But I would argue not everybody who commits a crime got a problem.
That's true.
Okay, that's true. I mean, let's just keep it real.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and I remember when when I was watching Tracy's story, and she spoke to some teen girls, mm-hmm. young women, and one of the young ladies said, "Yeah, when I was younger, I was off the chain." But my question is, why are they off the chain? What if it's not mental health, if it's not a headache, if it's not a broken home? What's
going
on?
I'd like to chime in here.
Yeah.
The state's attorney, I know, wants to chime in too, but I spent a lot of time in juvenile court in Prince George's County. I call it one of the most depressing places on earth.
I can imagine so.
And the energy in that courtroom is unique, in that you are watching children, and they are children, who are being just shuffled into this system. And it's one after the other, after the other, after the other. And when you really hear what's going on in these cases, what's very apparent to me is that oftentimes there is a lack of adult accountability for what's happening to this child and the decisions that they're making. There's an absence of adult authority and someone who's coming in to actually help these children. And then in other cases, you also have generational issues where the father was incarcerated or the mother was incarcerated. And so then the habits are just being repeated. But when the judges are dealing with just the law, and I understand why folks who are in those spaces would say we have got to find a way to divert, because the judges are so limited with what they can do. Right. And if you have offended, and if this is not your first time, but oftentimes in that court, there's just a feeling of, man, where was mom? Where was dad? Where was anybody to step in and redirect this kid before they got here? And the head's hanging low, and the depression, and the sadness, and just taking off their shoelaces and going into the back on their way to juvenile detention. It's a sad thing to watch.
Can this diversion address the litany of things that Tracy just mentioned?
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that one of our partners, CPAC, does is they actually do sessions for parents and guardians. Some of our children don't live with their parents. They live with a grandparent or another family member. And so sometimes there is a breakdown in the family structure. Sometimes there is not, as Tracy mentioned, that level of supervision that is required for young people who are growing up. And let's face it, not everybody has, a diagnosable mental health issue, but we all have been young once. Mm-hmm. And we've all made mistakes. And so the question is, what is the appropriate response for those mistakes? The juvenile system, the whole standard in evaluating cases in the juvenile system is what is in the best interest of the child. So that is the standard in the system. And all we're saying is that oftentimes putting a child further in a system is not in their best interest. And if we can discipline them, if we can hold them accountable, if we can make sure that the victim is also made whole and they are apologized to and they understand the wrong that was done, then that oftentimes is the better solution.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to the Prince George's County State's Attorney, the top prosecutor in Prince George's County, Aisha Brave Boy. If you have a comment, if you have a question, we will be talking to you. That includes Jimmy from Fort Washington, Gerard calling from D.C., and Tim also calling from D.C. Do not hang up. You will be able to hear the program. This conversation will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We will continue with this conversation on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. And by the way, if you're having difficulty getting through, please keep trying. I promise I will take your phone call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a few seconds.
Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking to Prince George's County State's Attorney Aisha Brave Boy about criminal justice issues in the county. Our guest reporter is Tracy Wilkins, the Prince George's County Bureau Chief for News 4 Washington. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Before I go to the phone lines, you have something coming up that really is going to be kind of a first for your administration, kind of a state of the justice system in Prince George. Just tell me about that briefly.
Yeah, I think, and I truly believe that we must all be transparent in how we administer justice, both the police department and, of course, the state's attorney's office and other actors and players in the criminal justice system. And so what I've decided to do was to have an annual State of Justice Conference where I lay out any changes that my office is making in terms of our policy and also some of the challenges that we see and cases that we're trying in our community and also areas where we need support from the community. So this is really a opportunity for the community to hear about what our office is doing and also to give us feedback and input into, you know, what they think they need from our office. So we'll be talking obviously about our youth justice reform, but we'll also be talking about other types of reform, like we are expanding our diversion programs offered in the county, and we're in the process of finalizing our policy around commercial sex workers because that's a very very vulnerable class of offenders who oftentimes come from very limited means. Many of them are addicted or have some social emotional issues as well.
Mm. And that's going to be on September 10th.
September 10th, which is a Tuesday, and it will be at the hotel in College Park, right on Baltimore Avenue, Route 1.
Okay, thank you so much. Let me go back to the phone lines. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tim, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Tim, are you there?
Tim's here.
Yeah, go right ahead, please.
Just to the point of the state's attorney was responding to the bureau chief's question about what the relationship would look like with the police officers in the school system, I think it's important to note that if, according to Dr. Golson's position, these police officers are acting as mentors as opposed to situations mm-hmm. where a conflict can escalate. She mentioned if an officer enters a situation and a student should strike them and how charges can escalate. If these officers are truly mentors, and again, this is to the point of both the question asked by the Bureau Chief and also by the state's attorney's response, when you see a mentor, it's less likely that the student will escalate that further. It would be similar or akin to if the student saw a parent suddenly when they were committing an offense, they would suddenly be taken aback. So I just wanted to make that point in answering the Bureau Chief's question that I think that mentorship is key in preventing the situations from escalating. That's okay. All I had.
Tim, thank you so much.
Tim.
Gerard, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Go right ahead.
All right. I got a quick question. As a person who has been reformed and who has really come to grips with everything that's out here, I just want to know, how can someone like me or more people be in position to help our youth when a lot of things are calling for more of certain degrees, you know, to help them, or certain credentials? But at the same time, we all know our youth in this area, they relate more to people just like them who right. can really, you know, create paths for them and they can believe in. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Please go right ahead.
And first of all, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And you're absolutely right. What we want young people to know is that there are options. They have a future. They should not be defined by their actions, but by how they advance after they've had that negative interaction or done that negative act, and then they have the ability to make better decisions in the future. And I think that that's what should define them, how they turn their life around. And so we have to, of course, be mindful of the fact that as a government agency, we, and when we refer individuals programs, we have to ensure, of course, the safety of those individuals who are in the programs. And so we often do background checks and have that as a policy. And it's almost required, quite frankly, especially if you're in the school system, and certainly if law enforcement is advocating for certain programs, we have to make sure that the child is in a safe environment. But we do have opportunities for people who have had offenses in the past to be able to interact with young people.
How would they do that? What opportunities?
Yeah.
Because that's what he's really
looking for. So we can put together panels as part of, let's say, a juvenile intervention program. We can put together panels, and we often have people who have offended come and talk to young people because we understand that they are better reached by people who have gone through the same, who walked in the same shoes. And so there are opportunities. So if he is interested, which others have contacted our office because they are interested in similar situations, please let us know. We certainly would love to have the support. I can be reached at the state attorney's office. I can give my email address, which is A as in apple, N as in Nancy, my last name, BRAVEBOY at co.pg.md.us. And if you do email us or email me, I will certainly refer you to our youth justice unit, and you will be contacted.
Mm-hmm. Gerard, thank you so much. And to the other issue that came up in reference to police, and this is one of the things that I think is crucial to your job. What is your relationship with Chief Hank Stawinski, and more broadly, the rank and file of the Prince George's County Police Department?
Well, I have a good working relationship with our chief. I also have a great working relationship with our sheriff. So all of our partners in law enforcement, we must have a good working relationship. You know, our relationship is unique in that not only do we have to work together, and I rely on the police department to conduct thorough investigations so they can bring cases to us that we can prosecute, but I'm also responsible for holding them accountable for their actions. And so if they violate, let's say, the constitutional rights of our citizens, if they use excessive force against our citizens and residents, my responsibility is to hold them accountable and prosecute when appropriate.
Is that balance difficult?
You know what? It's not for me because I believe in doing what's right. I'm very straightforward, forthright. I think that's why I was actually supported by the Fraternal Order of Police and all of the other public safety unions, not because they thought of me as a yes woman, but because they knew that I would be fair, I'd be honest and transparent. And that's all anyone can ask for in the criminal justice system, and that's what I've delivered thus far.
Oh, I thought you were going to.
I don't have a question.
Oh, okay. And the reason I ask is because last week, you know, Corporal Stephen Downey was convicted second degree assault misconduct in office, and I would argue that if the two officers, the lower ranking officers,
yes,
who testified against him in court, mm-hmm, first of all, were not men of integrity or officers of integrity, but secondly, more broadly, if officers do not respect your office, you, that it could make your job difficult.
It certainly could, and that's why, again, it's a balancing act. But as long as everyone understands our roles. And I am very clear about what my role is in this system. I am the top law enforcement officer in the county. I am responsible for protecting the constitutional rights of everyone, including the defendants. And in that case, the victim in that case involving Officer Downey was actually under arrest for fourth degree burglary. Mm-hmm. So this is someone who was under arrest for committing an offense, but had no right to be treated the way he was treated by Officer Downey. And so we held Officer Downey accountable for his actions, and we won a conviction, and he will be sentenced in October.
I have a question along the same lines, but just a little bit different, because I think that one of the things I'd like to bring attention to is the uniqueness of State's Attorney Bree Boy, in that she had not prosecuted cases before taking this office. The Washington Post did a really interesting article on the new wave of state's attorneys in the country, folks who are coming from a non-traditional perspective in holding offices like this across the country. And Aisha Bree Boy was one of the folks featured in that article as bringing a new approach. I think that we're hearing a little bit of that now and your approach to juvenile justice and the diversion. But can you talk a little bit about how your unique background, how that is impacting how you approach this office? It's very different from your predecessor, who is now the county executive for Prince George's County and was a career prosecutor. So explain how your approach is different.
So while I had not been a prosecutor prior to being elected, I did work with the criminal justice community. So, as I mentioned earlier, I worked with the Community Public Awareness Council for 15 years. And a big part of getting that program off the ground was the relationship we had with the police department. In fact, we started the program in a police substation in the Kettering Largo Shopping Center. Now, we're still in the Kettering Largo Shopping Center, but now we're in it. Well, now that program, I'm no longer affiliated with in my new role, but that program is now in another space in the Kettering Largo Shopping Center. So Carrollton Enterprises, who owns that shopping center, has been a big part of what we do, and I'm so grateful for the partnerships we've had with the community. But the police officers have come in and talked to the young people. Also, our sheriff, Melvin High, is a big part of that program. So what I think is that, looking at coming into this job, it's not about prosecution only. Being the state's attorney is really about solving the problems of the community. And I've been a problem solver in our community for well over a decade. And so sometimes solving a problem does mean prosecution. And I'm not afraid to move forward with prosecution when that is the most appropriate avenue. But oftentimes, there are cases that are more appropriate for diversion. And I'm not afraid to divert those cases either. And what I believe is that if I show the type of leadership which I have shown, which is being very transparent, very open, being data-driven, bringing all of the players together in the system to collaborate on the best approaches, that is the way to solve the problem and make our community safer in the future. So far, everyone's really bought into that approach because I put everyone at the table.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I believe it is Mahila from Prince George's County. Go right ahead, Mahila.
Mahalia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Go right ahead.
No problem. My question is for Mrs. Bree Boy. My question is, have you ever thought about bringing teachers and educators to a focus group or some type of assembly to make sure that we are actually targeting the kids that we want to target, because mm-hmm. we are in the forefront. We are the ones that see these kids day
Absolutely.
In and day out who are actually the mentor, the parent, and all those other things to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to do. They are the ones that come to us after graduation mm-hmm. asking us to come to football games or come, to do other things that parents don't normally do because they're not there.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great things about taking a collaborative approach to solving the problems in our community is that we have reached out to Dr. Golson, and we are working on finalizing a memorandum of understanding, and we will work with our teachers. I know that the union president, Teresa Dudley, has been a big proponent of ending the school-to-prison pipeline, and she understands and the members understand that they're a big part of, you know, the progress in that and how they relate to young people, especially those who exhibit bad behavior in their classrooms. So absolutely, the teachers must and will be at the table.
Thank you so much, Mahalia. Let's go to Jimmy calling from Fort Washington. Jimmy, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
First of all, I'd like to applaud the state's attorney because I really feel like she gets it, you know. And after explaining your background, I understand now you're grassroots.
Yes.
You know, when you dug in and you have a vested interest, your whole scope is different, you know. So I'd like to thank you for that. And but mainly, you know, I'm a retired law enforcement for 30 years.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. I first was a state police officer, and then I went into corrections, parole and probation. But most importantly, I was a foster parent, you know, because I'm a product of the Upward Bound program. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Yeah. So, Jimmy, so what's your comment or question? I want to make sure. Go right ahead, please.
Sure, no problem. My thing is that I would like to, you know, applaud you, number one. And then again, what the young lady mentioned in reference to the schools mm-hmm. is that if when it comes to kids and dealing in schools and their problems and their issues, to me what they're doing is they're crying out for help. You know, but they're crying out in different ways. You know, they may aggravate the teacher, the school, and what have you. But, you know, I would like to become a part of assisting you with this because, you know, this has been, to me, what I really feel like that I'm meant to do other than dealing in law enforcement. I did what I had to do for 30 years. Now I like to do what I want to do.
We would certainly love to have your support. And, you know, I gave my email address earlier, but I'll say it one more time. And please email me, A as in Apple, N as in Nancy, my last name, which is Brave Boy, B-R-A-V as in Victory, E as in Echo, B-O-Y, at co.pg.md.us.
Okay.
All right.
Jimmy, thank you so much. And by the way, as always, in addition to the podcast for this broadcast and every broadcast on the Daily Drum, that information for reaching out to the county state's attorney will be posted on our website on WHUR.com tonight after 8:30. So, Jimmy, again, thank you so much. One of the things I did want to turn the conversation to is DUI prosecutions and the like. A case that came up last week, Jenny Matei, 8 years served for a 2010 DUI. Two men were killed. Help me with this because I'm trying to get clarity on what is happening. She wants to get out on parole, get out early. What is that situation there?
She wants to be sentenced to a treatment facility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she killed two men.
She did.
She killed two men, has detrimentally impacted families, and that would, you know, forever, and that's an understatement.
Absolutely.
But what does the law say?
I just want to add a little bit more before you. Because this is a story that I covered. That not only did she kill these two men, but she is a multiple DUI offender. That was not her first DUI.
This was her fourth arrest.
And she had been in and out of treatment facilities beforehand. And so being in court and listening to the families who are left after these victims were killed and hearing them cry out to the judge, and this is a case, I'm happy that you brought it up, that people really need to know what's going on in our court system because we're waiting on the judge to render a decision in this case. She did not render a decision there with the family in the courtroom. She's going to email the attorneys, you know, what she thinks should happen. There's a possibility that in that email that she'll say, I think it's fine for her to go on to this treatment facility. But this is someone who, in addition to the DUIs, also has a longstanding history of other crimes and a pretty long, lengthy criminal record as well. What the family argued is that this is someone with a disregard for the law, and that if we were to put her back out on the streets, while she was on bond, she was at bars drinking before she was convicted of this case. So I just wanted to add a little bit more, too, and then I'm also very curious to hear what the state's attorney has to say.
Yeah, thank you for that, Tracy. I really appreciate it.
And there's just a little bit more. Even after she was sentenced and while she has been confined, she has also continued to rack up sanctions against her for a variety of infractions while she has been incarcerated. And so I'm all about treatment and getting people the help they need. But at some point, when you have shown that you are not interested in getting that treatment, or you're going to do the bare minimum just so that you can move on to the next level, we are not going to have or exercise our mercy on you. And so she had, as Tracy mentioned, numerous opportunities to get it right. She didn't. The facility that her attorney would like her to be sentenced to does not have the level of supervision we think is required for someone who's exhibited the type of behavior that she has exhibited. And so we are opposing her transfer to this treatment facility. She has been getting treatment in the facility that she's in now, and we believe she should remain there and serve her sentence.
How long is the total sentence?
Her total sentence is 20 years. Mm-hmm. And she would be required, because it is not, while it's not considered a crime of violence, because of her multiple offenses prior to this one.
Help me with that.
Okay.
Whoa. Because help me with my common sense. Because you just said because of her prior offenses, it would not be considered a crime of violence.
No. I'm saying, the reason why she has to at minimum do half of her time.
Okay.
Based on, and that's not the state's attorney's
right.
Responsibility. We're not responsible for her once she is sentenced. She then is in under the supervision of the Department of Corrections.
Right.
And they have what's called diminution credits. And so there are things that she can do to get an earlier release than her total time where she was confined. And the reason why I talk about the fact that it's not considered a crime of violence is that generally with crimes of violence, you have to serve at minimum half of your time. And so even though I believe, quite frankly, motor vehicle manslaughter should be considered a crime of violence, it is not under the law. So I have to, again, I'm here to enforce the law, and so we understand that. So it's not considered a crime of violence, not because we don't believe it is, but because by law it is not. But because of her prior offenses, she was not given the level of consideration in the Department of Corrections that other individuals would have been given under similar circumstances. So sometimes a person who's convicted of, let's say, a crime that's not considered a crime of violence may only do, a smaller percentage, so less than half of the time. Sometimes it's a quarter of the time. Sometimes it's a third. Sometimes it's a little bit more. So it's kind of a graduated scale based on the nature of the offense. But for her, again, we have very little mercy. She has continued to offend even while confined. And so we are arguing very vigorously that she needs to remain where she is.
One of the points that her attorney made in court is that she's eligible for parole at this mm-hmm. point, and at some point is going to be released into the community. So how do you want her released? Do you want her released with an intense alcohol program that can try to get at her issue or not? Which was an interesting question, and one that the judge is going to ponder. But one of the questions that I wanted to...
But that doesn't mean she has to be released to that program now.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, because we have, we've done stories on DUI offenses and the rest of it. I think it would have seemed to a lot of Marylanders that when it comes to DUIs, Maryland is a pretty easy state on DUI offenses and people who get behind the wheel and drink and drive. What are your impressions of this, and how does this impact you doing what you all are trying to do?
Well, let me just tell you, I am focused on these motor vehicle manslaughter cases and also DUIs, because I feel that this is an area where we can really make a significant impact, because people don't need to get behind the wheel while they're impaired, period. These are bad choices that people are making, and they're destroying lives. So I'm sending that message in my office. One of the things that we have been able to do, which in the past has not been done, is we've been able to indict these cases a lot sooner. It used to take about 8 to 10 months to indict DUI cases. But working with our police department, again, this is where the partnership comes into play. They have been working with us, both the state police and Prince George's County Police, to speed up those investigations so that we are able to bring justice to families a lot sooner. So the past couple of motor vehicle manslaughter cases that we are trying were indicted within a month or a month and a half. And so we've really cut down on the amount of time that families are in limbo, wondering whether or not the person who they believe took the life of their loved one will be held accountable. So that's important. And then in the case, we had a case off of a 210, the Hawks case, that was the first motor vehicle manslaughter case that I indicted. We were able to secure a plea in that case, and that defendant will be sentenced in September.
No, please,
this is
ahead.
The case where the three children were killed in the crash.
And what's important about that is that the mother said to me on the day of the plea that she thought this was going to take years, and so they're grateful that this will all be over, or at least this part will all be over in September, so that they can heal and get on with their lives. And that's really important to us. So our job is to send, you know, is to hold people accountable, but we are also sending a message. We have a campaign launched called Drive Focus, Sober and Safe. And so we're letting people know, look, if you are getting on the roadways, you must pay attention to all traffic laws, including staying sober, or else our job is to hold you accountable.
Why does there at least appear to be mm-hmm. so much secrecy around the SUV case on 301 that involved the state police, where all of those children were
yes.
killed? And what is because that is a DUI case, is it not?
That case was indicted.
Yeah. Okay.
So that case was indicted maybe about 2 or 3 months ago.
So mm-hmm. so where are we now with that case?
So we are planning to at this point go to trial. I can't remember exactly when the trial is scheduled for, but at this point we're expecting to go to trial.
Why it just seemed that while this case was kind of moving through, there was just there just seemed to be so little information coming out as opposed to some of the other DUI cases that we've seen. Why?
Well, every case is different. And, you know, depending on, you know, whether or not there were eyewitnesses who were, you know, citizens versus in many cases, or in this case, the accident took place, you know, very early in the morning, I think around 4:30 a.m. And so there were very few people on the roadway. I don't believe there were any civilian witnesses to it. And oftentimes law enforcement does not reveal too much information because, number one, as the state's attorney, we're not really allowed to try cases in public. So we can't give out a lot of information. And police are very leery sometimes about giving out information, especially when they're still in the midst of conducting an investigation. And that case is a little bit more complex than, let's say, the one on 210. And so I think that part of the reason why you haven't heard a lot is because of the nature of the investigation that was conducted into that case. But the defendant or the driver in that case was indicted.
I want to thank both of you for coming in and sharing in this conversation. Of course, Prince George's County State's Attorney Aisha Braveboy and Tracy Wilkins, Prince George's County Bureau Chief for News 4 Washington. I appreciate you both coming in.
Good to be
and
here.
We
you.
Will continue to watch with our ears to the ground.
Thank you
so much. That
thank
is the
you.
Daily Drama on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, August 12th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.